You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 19th. I'm Logan Kolbrich from Drake University. Here's our first story. Forecast. High of 48, but windy today in metro area. Expect some wind today. The high today is 48, with gusts of wind up to 38 miles per hour possible. According to the National Weather Service, the morning will see temps in the 30s before it warms up some. The evening is low 34, with wind speeds up to 20 miles per hour possible. Winterfest will be held in Bayless Park from 5:30 to 8 p.m. As we advised on Thursday, please be sure to bundle up. Here's a look at the upcoming forecast according to the Weather Service. Friday will be partly sunny with a high near 48, breezy with a south wind of 11 to 21 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 38 miles per hour. Friday night will be mostly cloudy with a low around 34, south wind 6 to 10 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 20 miles per hour. Saturday will be mostly cloudy with a high near 52, south wind around 6 miles per hour, becoming north-northeast in the afternoon. Saturday night, partly cloudy with a low around 32. Sunday will be sunny with a high near 48. Sunday night will be partly cloudy with a low around 22. Monday will be mostly sunny with a high near 40. And Monday night will be mostly clear with a low around 29. Micah House receives $50,000 for fight against food insecurity. Photo, Jenny Anderson, Director of Marketing and Community Development with The Micah House, speaks outside the shelter's hoop house. During the growing season, women stay at the shelter, will work a couple times a week to raise produce in the hoop house on Lakin campus on North 16th Street. The women, along with community volunteers, recently finished harvesting for the year. Entering the holiday season, the Micah House homeless shelter just got some help in the fight against food insecurity. Google announced Thursday it has awarded a $50,000 grant to the Micah House Emergency Family Shelter to support its shelter and food programs. It was one of 20 grants given to innovate food pantries, food banks, and food assistance programs, according to the company. Since the beginning of COVID-19 pandemic, Google has contributed more than $20 million in employee donations and company matches to food banks and pantries around the world, a press release from Google stated. When we hear from families, especially around the holidays, that they are grateful to have a place to sleep at night, it is only possible because of the generous community support from individuals and companies like Google, said Ashley Flatter, Associate Director of the Micah House, located in Charles E. Lake and Human Services campus at North 16th Street and Avenue G. The grant provided by Google will directly help those facing food insecurities and allow children, their parents, and women experiencing homelessness in our community to have safer shelter as they get back on their feet. In 2020, the Micah House served 34,284 nutritious meals to families and women experiencing homelessness, according to an impact statement on its website. "We're very much in the business of feeding people," Flatter said. During the growing season, women staying at the shelter work a couple times a week to raise produce in a hoop house on the Lakin campus, according to Jenny Anderson, Director of Marketing and Community Development. The women, along with community volunteers, recently finished harvesting for the year. The hoop house was set up in September 2011 by Iowa Western Community College construction technology students with the help of a $25,000 grant the college received from Learn and Serve America, a federally funded program of the Corporation for National and Community Service. It was initially shared by the Micah House and the Boys and Girls Club and tended by children from both places, as well as community volunteers. The shelter also picks up food donations from local grocery stores and restaurants and shares some perishables with food pantries, Flatter said. "Anytime we have enough overflow, especially food that won't be able to use in time, we share that with our partners," she said. "The last thing we want to see is food going to waste." Some food, of course, has to be purchased, especially meat, Flatter said. Besides financial support, Google has worked to expand and update information available to consumers through its search engine. "Every day, hundreds of thousands of people come to Google Search to find information on food assistance. Between Thanksgiving and the New Year, searches for food banks and pantries spike on Google. In fact, for more than a decade, search interest on Google for food bank and food pantry queries spiked by 30 to 50% every November," Google's press release stated. The pandemic has escalated food insecurity across the country. In Iowa, Google searches for food pantry near me went up 50% in 2021, and search interest in Snap reached an all-time high in January 2021. The company said, The pandemic has escalated food insecurity across the country. In Iowa, Google searches for food pantry near me went up 50% in 2021, and search interest in Snap reached an all-time high in January 2021, the company said. Interest in helping has also increased, with searches for volunteer opportunities near me rising by 160%. The pandemic has increased the number of families facing food insecurity, including right here in Iowa, the Council Bluffs Mayor Matt Walsh said in the release. New tools launched Thursday by Google, a key community partner in Council Bluffs, will make it easier for families to find assistance. Google's donation to the Micah House will also directly aid in their mission to combat hunger in our community. To help people find food and give back, Google said it has added several new features. Google is working with Why Hunger and Hunger Free America to update information on food banks and pantries available through Google Search and Maps, which already have 24,000 food banks and pantry listings, according to the press release. Google employees have spent more than 7,000 hours on the phone to help verify Google Maps listings. Food banks, pantries, and soup kitchens can also use the new Google My Business feature developed specifically for them to highlight hours of operation, services, types of donations accepted, and appointment availability where applicable. Federal benefit programs like the Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program feed more than 40 million Americans each year. As of Thursday, when people search for SNAP benefits or the name of their local SNAP program, they will find direct links to their state's eligibility guidelines and application process, as well as contact information for local food assistance agencies, the company said. Users can also search for stores that accept EBT near me and find a list of grocery, convenience stores, and farmers markets nearby that accept EBT as a payment method. Tens of millions of people face food insecurity across the United States, and the ongoing pandemic has only exacerbated the issue, Emily Ma, head of Floor for Good at Google, said in the release. With the launch of these new features, we are looking to ensure that all Americans get the information they need to put their food on tables, and we're proud of the highlight. Tens of millions of people face food insecurity across the United States, and the ongoing pandemic has only exacerbated the issue. Emily Ma, head of Tens of millions of people face food insecurity across the United States, and the ongoing pandemic has only exacerbated the issue, Emily Ma, head of Floor for Good at Google, said in the release. With the launch of these new features, we're working to ensure that all Americans get the information that they need to put their food on their tables, and we're proud to highlight the organizations doing the critical work to tackle food insecurity head on. Faith Briefs. Local churches plan services, events. New Horizon Presbyterian Church. New Horizon Presbyterian Church, 30 Valley View Drive, has traditional services at 8 a.m. and 11, and they praise service at 9 a.m. Sunday school is at 10 a.m. on New Horizon Presbyterian Church, 30 Valley View Drive, has traditional services at 8 a.m. and 11, and the praise service at 9 a.m. Sunday school is at 10 a.m. on Wednesday. New Horizon Presbyterian Church. New Horizon Presbyterian Church, 30 Valley View Drive, has traditional services at 8 a.m. and 11, and the praise service at 9 a.m. Sunday school is at 10 a.m. On Wednesday, the Dulcimer Group practices at 4:30 to 5:30 p.m., the praise team at 5:45 to 6:30 p.m., the Chancel Bell Choir at 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., and the Chancel Choir at 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. New Horizon will host the Council Bluffs Presbyterian Churches for a joint Thanksgiving service on Sunday, 4 p.m. Enjoy fellowship and dessert following the service. The CDC advises everyone, vaccinated or not, to wear a mask indoors in public if you're in an area of high transmission, such as Pottawatomie County. Please consider wearing a mask regardless of your vaccination status. Remember to use hand sanitizer frequently and maintain your social distance. Food and coffee will remain unavailable. Children are welcome to attend, but the nursery will not be available. If you are ill, please worship from your home by watching our Facebook page. Underwood Lutheran Church, 10 3rd Avenue, will hold Sunday activities Underwood Lutheran Church. Underwood Lutheran Church, 10 3rd Avenue, will hold Sunday activities. Education begins at 9, in-person worship begins at 10:15 a.m., and will feature Holy Communion. Online worship is available later in the day. Reverend Scott Dalen will deliver a sermon based on 18 verse 33-37. Hazel Dell United Methodist Church. Hazel Dell United Methodist Church, 23109 205th Street, is handicap accessible and membership is not necessary to participate. The church is open for worship at 9 a.m. on Sundays and will maintain social distancing. Masks are not required but are available for those who need/want one, and we have plenty of hand sanitizer. We will meet in the church sanctuary. If you are sick, please do not join us. If you decide to not to attend at this time, you can join us in worship at home through Facebook Live. We are in prayer for all those affected by the virus. You can check us out at facebook.com/HazelDellUMCC. Hazel Dell United Methodist Church. Hazel Dell United Methodist Church, 23109 205th Street, is handicap accessible and membership is not necessary to participate. The church is open for worship at 9 a.m. on Sundays and we will maintain social distancing. Masks are not required but are available for those who want/need one, and we have plenty of hand sanitizer. We will meet in the church sanctuary. If you are sick, please do not join us. If you decide not to join at this time, you can join us in worship at home through Facebook Live. We are in prayer for all those affected by the virus. You can check us out at facebook.com/HazelDellUMCC. Crater Lake United Methodist Church. Crater Lake United Methodist Church, 3025 Marbury Lane in Crater Lake, would like to invite the public to join us in our live Sunday worship service at 11 a.m. on Sunday mornings. Sunday school for children is at 10:30 a.m. and face masks are optional. Crater Lake United Methodist Church. Crater Lake United Methodist Church, 3025 Marbury Lane in Crater Lake, would like to invite the public to join us in our live Sunday worship service at 11 a.m. on Sunday mornings. Sunday school for children is at 10:30 a.m. and face masks are optional. The Sunday worship can also be viewed on our Facebook page, Crater Lake Iowa Methodist Church. Other events in this week include AA meeting on Monday at 7 p.m., NA meeting on Monday at 7 p.m., Bible study on Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. On Tuesday, the aircraft idea exchange. Crater Lake United Methodist Church, 3025 Marbury Lane in Crater Lake, would like to invite the public to join us in our live Sunday worship service at 11 a.m. on Sunday mornings. Sunday school for children is at 10:30 a.m. and face masks are optional. The Sunday worship can also be viewed on our Facebook page, Crater Lake Iowa Methodist Church. Other events this week include AA meetings on Monday at 7 p.m., NA meetings on Monday at 7 p.m., Bible study on Tuesday at 5:30 p.m., on Tuesday, and the aircraft. Crater Lake United Methodist Church, 3025 Marbury Lane in Crater Lake, would like to invite the public to join us in our live Sunday worship at 11 a.m. on Sunday mornings. Sunday school for children is at 10:30 a.m. and face masks are optional. The Sunday worship can also be viewed on our Facebook page, Crater Lake Iowa United Methodist Church. Other events this week include AA meeting on Monday at 7 p.m., an NA meeting on Monday at 7 p.m., Bible study on Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday, and the aircraft ID exchange on Thursday at 1 p.m. in the Fellowship Hall. There will be a special Thanksgiving Eve service at 6 p.m. on Wednesday. Gethsemane Presbyterian Church. Gethsemane Presbyterian Church, Gethsemane Presbyterian Church, 224 Wallace Avenue, invites you to worship on Sunday. Our service runs from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Children are invited to participate in Sunday school. Reverend Dr. Irwin G. Steinmetz will be delivering the message, giving thanks. Refreshments will be served following service. Adult Bible study meets on Monday and Thursday from 9 to 10 a.m. Our food pantry is also open on Monday and Thursday until 10:30 a.m. for those who need assistance and for anyone who wishes to drop off food items or monetary donations to support our effort. For more information, contact the church office at 712-366-2513 or visit us on Facebook at GethsemanePresbyterianChurch.org. Bethany Presbyterian Church. Bethany Presbyterian Church, 1900 South 7th Street. Bethany Presbyterian Church. Bethany Presbyterian Church, 1900 South 7th Street, will have in-person worship at 10:30 a.m. on Sunday. Reverend Cindy Harvey's message will be "So You Are King" in the scripture John 18 verse 33-37. Linguist is Sue Perry, and the greeters are Sherry Dillahay and Linda Cody. We will partake in Holy Communion. Deacons will meet at 10:30 a.m. There will be decorating of the church for Advent season after worship. There will be a Thanksgiving service at New Horizon Presbyterian Church, 30 Valley View Drive, at 4 p.m. on Sunday. Session will meet on Saturday at 9:30 a.m. We will be collecting food items for the pantry and also hats, gloves, and mittens this whole month of November. It is recommended that we wear masks and sanitize. We are a handicap accessible facility. St. John Lutheran Church. St. John Lutheran Church, 633 Willow Avenue, holds worship at 5:30 p.m. on Saturday and 9:30 a.m. on Sunday. Masks are recommended, and worship will be available to watch on YouTube. Our website is stjohneelca.org, and our Facebook page is St. John Lutheran Church, Council Bluffs, Iowa. Our nursery remains closed for the time being. Sunday school starts at 10:45 a.m. in the sanctuary. Wednesday morning Bible study meets at 9 a.m., and Wednesday evening Bible study meets at 6 p.m. Confirmation class and high school youth meets at 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday evenings, and the choir practice starts 7 p.m. We will be having our annual Thanksgiving Eve First Communion service on Wednesday at 7 p.m., with a pie social following the service. The building is handicap accessible. Please call the church office with any questions at 712-323-7173. Compass Christian Church. Compass Christian Church, 2007 South 7th Street, welcomes you to worship on Sunday at 10:30 a.m. A cry room and children's classes are available. You may also worship with us online at compasscbchurch.online.church. Weekly schedules include men's Bible study on Mondays at 7:30 p.m., Wednesday nights from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Includes groups for kids, kindergarten through 5th grades, students in 6th grade and 12th grade at the prayer group meets. Men's and women's groups are held at various times throughout the year. Complete information can be found on Facebook at Compass Christian Church CB, compasscb.org, or the church office at 712-366-7112. Mount Hope United Methodist Church. Mount Hope United Methodist Church, 19022 290th Street in McClelland, welcomes you all to join worship service on Sunday mornings at 9:30 p.m. Children are welcome for the regular worship service and children's sermon during the service. Upcoming events are Friday, December 24th at 4 p.m. Mount Hope United Methodist Church. Mount Hope United Methodist Church, 19022 290th Street in McClelland, welcomes you all to join our worship service on Sunday mornings at 9:30 a.m. Children are welcome for the regular worship service and children's sermon during the service. Upcoming events are Friday, December 24th at 4 p.m. will be our Candlelight Christmas Eve service. On January 10th, 2022, we will have a council meeting at 8:30, followed by our breakfast and worship at 9:30 a.m. in our fellowship room. Everyone is welcome, and you do not have to be a member of the church to participate in our activities. Timothy Lutheran Church. Timothy Lutheran Church, 3112 West Broadway, will have a traditional worship service with Holy Communion at 8 and 10:30 a.m., The 8 a.m. service is live-streamed on Timothy's Facebook page. If you do not have Facebook, you can connect with Timothy on its webpage after 3 p.m. on Sunday afternoon at timothylutheran.net. Sunday school classes meet at 9:15 a.m. Adult Bible study is at 9:15 a.m. on Sunday, and midweek Bible study will meet on Thursday from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Timothy has an elevator for easy access to worship services and other activities. Epworth United Methodist Church. Epworth United Methodist Church, 2447 Avenue B. Epworth United Methodist Church. Epworth United Methodist Church, 2447 Avenue B, would like to invite the public to Sunday worship at 9:25 a.m. and social distancing will be in place. The church is handicap accessible and membership is not necessary to participate. Masks are not required but are available for those who need or want one. And we have plenty of hand sanitizer. We'll meet in the church sanctuary. If you are sick, please do not join us. The scripture for this coming Sunday is Revelation 1, verse 4-8, and John 18, verse 33-37. There's a Bible study on Thursdays at 9 a.m. We are in prayer for all those affected by the virus. Prayer requests can be made at upworthumccb.org/aboutus/our-values. Office hours are 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., Monday through Friday. The office phone number is 712-323-3124. You can check us out at facebook.com/pages/Epworth. Faith Lutheran Church. Faith Lutheran Church, 2100 South 11th Street, will have a traditional worship with Holy Communion at 9 a.m. Sunday worship service. Faith Lutheran Church. Faith Lutheran Church, 2100 South 11th Street, will have traditional worship with Holy Communion at the 9 a.m. Sunday worship service. Tuesday, there is a 9:30 a.m. adult Bible study that is open to everyone in the church fellowship hall. Please enter by the rear door. Tuesday, there is also an elders meeting at 2:30 p.m. Faith is observing social distancing, but masks are optional. Services are also available on Faith's Facebook page and on YouTube by searching to Ron Rosenkamer. The Faith Life Ministry is collecting children's winter hats, gloves, and mittens to be donated to Longfellow Elementary, and there's a box in the narthex marked for the congregation to place donations in. For more information about worship opportunities at Faith, contact the church office at 323-6445. Westminster Presbyterian Church. Westminster Presbyterian Church, 517 South 32nd Street, welcomes everyone to worship on Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Guest speaker is Reverend Cindy Harvey, and her sermon is Christ the King, with scriptures Daniel 9, verse 7 through 10, 13-14, and John 18, verse 33 through 37. We are handicapped accessible through the northeast door of the church. Broadway United Methodist Church. Broadway United Methodist Church, 11 South 1st Street, is ready to simplify local merrymakers Christmas baking with the United Methodist Women of Broadway United Methodist Church. The group is holding a drive-up cookie walk. Pre-ordered boxes containing 24 cookies and candies each are being offered for $10 per box. Orders will be available for pickup December 10th through 12th at the church. To place an order, call 712-322-7741 or go to BroadwayUnitedMethodistChurch.com/events and fill out the online form. Champions, Titans win state crown in 30T. Photo, Lewis Central Luciano Fadone, right kneeling, makes an improbable catch against Xavier defender Kevin Roth on the left running during the second quarter of the Titans' Class 4A championship against Xavier in Cedar Falls on Thursday, November 18th, 2021. Three overtimes, a long delay caused by stadium lights going out, and a goal line stand makes a memorable night for Lewis Central football on Thursday night in Class 4A state championship game in Cedar Falls. Lewis Central and Cedar Rapids Xavier battled back and forth for over 3 hours, but it was the Titans that took home the state title with a 32-24 victory. Before the start of the third overtime, the lights went out, causing a delay. The long break didn't slow down the Titans' offense as junior quarterback Braylon Comard scored 3 plays later on a 1-yard sneak. Lewis Central avoided disaster when junior Lucardio Fidon bobbled the hold on the extra point, but picked up the ball and scored it for a 2-point conversion. Xavier got down to the 1-yard line but was stopped twice on quarterback sneaks on third and fourth down, giving Lewis Central the state championship. Lewis Central defense made a stop on the first possession of the game after a sack left St. Louis a third and a long. Junior Jonathan Humpel carried the ball 7 times on the ensuing drive for the 52 yards, but a dropped pass and a failed third down conversion left the Titans trying for a field goal attempt, which sailed wide right. Senior Wyatt Hatcher gave Lewis Central a second chance when he intercepted a pass on the next drive and returned it to the 15-yard line. But Xavier held strong and forced another field goal attempt, which junior Boston Hensley sent through the uprights from 30 yards out. The field goal gave Lewis Central a 3-0 lead with 1 minute left in the first quarter. Lewis Central's defense forced another punt on the following drive. Comrade showed off his arm on the next drive, completing 4 passes to 3 different receivers, senior Braden Lofton, Fidone, and sophomore Curtis Witt. The Titans finally crossed the goal line on a 2-yard rush from Humple, giving LC a 10-0 lead with just over 4 minutes left in the first half. Xavier scored 3 points of its own before it had the end of the first half to cut the lead to 10-3. Halftime adjustments paid off for both defenses, with neither side scoring. There were 3 punts in the third. The Saints looked to be in prime position to tie the game up in the beginning of the fourth, but LC senior Nick Miller stripped the ball with around 8 minutes left in the game to give his team the ball up 7 at their own 20-yard line. Lewis Central wasn't able to do anything on offense and punted the ball with 6 minutes left in the game. Xavier tied up the game on the next drive with an 11-yard rush from senior quarterback Alex Neal. Lewis Central then set up the Saints with a great field position after snapping the ball over the punter's head. The Saints set up at the Titans 40 with a chance to win with under 4 minutes left in the game. But Lewis Central's defense was helped by a holding penalty and stepped up to force a three and out. Neither team scored on their final possession of the regulation, forcing overtime. Lewis Central scored first overtime on a 10-yard pass from Comrade to Fidone, but Xavier responded 2 plays later on an 8-yard strike. Xavier scored first and second overtime with a 5-yard run from Neal, but Lewis Central responded with when Comrade from Lofton in the back of the end zone for the touchdown to tie the game. The third overtime started around a 20-minute delay before the game ended on Titans state title winning goal line stand. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 19th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Logan Culbers from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa 877-404-4747. Opinion section. Williams. Censorship is being weaponized as a tool of exclusion. School districts need to stop book banning. All Boys Aren't Blue, a young adult memoir, weaves together the trials and triumphs faced by Black queer boys and is both a premiere for teens eager to be allies as well as reassuring testimony for young queer men of color, according to the author's website. The New York Times called this book by George M. Johnson, an alumnus of Virginia Union University, an exuberant, unapologetic memoir infused with a deep but clear-eyed love for its subjects. The New York Times called this book by George M. Johnson, an alumnus of Virginia Union University, an exuberant, unapologetic memoir infused with a deep but clear-eyed love for its subjects. School Library Journal praised the book for being anchored with encouragement and realistic guidance for queer Black youth. It's been amazing. I thought I had written something that was good. I didn't realize it was going to have the international impact that it already has. I didn't realize how many people were looking for this particular story. Johnson, who is non-binary. It's been amazing. I thought I had written something that was good. I didn't realize it was going to have the international impact it already has. I didn't realize how many people were looking for this particular story, Johnson, who was non-binary, said during an interview on Tuesday. But for those who aren't part of a growing censorship movement in our schools, All Boys Aren't Blue is pornography. Johnson, who is from Plainfield, New Jersey, says the book has been attacked in 10 states, including Virginia. A school board member in Flagler County, Florida, filed a criminal complaint over the book. That's peculiar, Johnson says, because the 320-page book probably contains less than 10 pages with sexual content and doesn't mention sex until chapter 11. They're coming for this book because I'm Black and queer, Johnson says. During a movement when right-wing forces seem intent on expelling Black narratives from schoolhouse, Johnson is not alone in lamenting that the targets of the censorship campaign often seem to be LGBTQ or authors of color. This fall, Henrico County, Virginia public schools filed from its pulled from its high school libraries the acclaimed book Out of Darkness by Ashley Hope Perez about a teenage romance between a Black boy and a Mexican girl in 1930s Texas. Meanwhile, New Kent County, Virginia, public schools removed from its middle school library Elizabeth Efesado's The Poet X, winner of National Book Award for Young People's Literature, among other honors. This seems to be, to me, connected to the discourse about critical race theory and related to that, said Mary Bauer, executive director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia. It's all about censorship in the classroom, censorship in the school system, depriving kids of information, and discourse that is inclusive and accurate. Bauer said the school should be settled law after Island Trees School District versus PICO, a 1982 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court said that restricted... Bauer said this should be settled after a law after Island Trees School District versus PICO, a 1982 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that restricted the powers of junior high school and high school officials to remove books based on their content. That ruling has not prevented subsequent waves of book ban fever. This is a primary issue of concern to the ACLU of Virginia that people should be entitled to learn and read about which they want to read and learn, Bauer said. Why are we fighting about this again in 2020-21? I don't know. But it seems to be part of the story that parents don't want their kids to feel uncomfortable. Parents don't want their kids to learn the full truth, and that is deeply concerning. In addition to opening school districts up to litigation, it prevents students from having an open and accurate dialogue about American history, and that is a real disservice to our children. The fear of transgender students in school bathrooms seems to have morphed into an antipathy toward their stories on school library shelves. What's at work, whether it's the history of systemic racism in America or the trials and tribulations of young LGBTQ people, is an attempted erasure. The folks on the right love to call liberals and progressives snowflakes, but they're treating their children like fragile china, unable to absorb historical facts and literary traumas that many adolescents are actually experiencing. A creeping fundamentalism grounded in fears about race and sexuality is undermining education and American values. Spotsylvania County, Virginia school board member went viral urging the burning of books amid the caterwauling about Marxism and socialism. Elected officials are barking signals from the totalitarian playbook. This parental rights movement is less about protecting one's own children than about imposing their will on a diverse community. The schoolhouse is not a personal playground of the loudest voices. It should be a clearinghouse of information that speaks to the entire community. Kids come packaged in different hues, genders, experiences, and maturity levels. They aren't one size fits all. The book should be available for those who can handle the material. Schools need to quit the book banning. Censorship's main lesson is exclusion. Obituaries. Carl Barr, 1935 to 2021. Carl Barr, age 86, passed away November 15, 2021, at White Pine Senior Living in Cottage Grove, Minnesota, where he had lived since May of 2022. Obituaries. Carl Barr, 1935 to 2021. Carl Barr, age 86, passed away November 15, 2021, at White Pine Senior Living in Cottage Grove, Minnesota, where he had lived since May of 2020. Carl was born on October 10, 1935, to the late Carl and Stella Barr. He graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1954. Carl worked as a train man for the Illinois Central Railroad for 42 years, retiring in 1995. He was united in marriage with his wife Evelyn Springer in 1995, where they were blessed with four sons, Joe, John, Scott, and Neil. He was also survived by his sister Betty Carlson of Akron, Ohio, 9 grandchildren, and 13 great-grandchildren. A celebration of life will be held at a later date, cremation at Crescent Tide Crematorium in St. Paul, Minnesota. No funeral, celebration of life at a later date. Sports. Hall of Famer Jim Calhoun stepping down as men's basketball coach at St. Joseph's. Sports. Hall of Famer Jim Calhoun stepping down as men's basketball coach at St. Joseph. Hartford, Connecticut. Jim Calhoun, who has written a memorable postscript in his Hall of Fame coaching career at University of St. Joseph, will step down effective immediately as the men's basketball coach. "You've got to know when it's time," Calhoun told the Hartford Courant Thursday. "We're a really good team. The program is in great shape. We're going in the right direction. Now is the time." Calhoun, 79, who led the UConn men to the 3 national championships, has had numerous health issues through the years, overcoming cancer and heart disease, but said he and his wife Pat are in good health now. He will turn the program over to Glenn Miller, who has been his associate head coach, and plans to spend holidays with his family and head to Hilton Head, South Carolina, where he has a vacation home. "Back home in Pomfret, there is a happy woman right now," Calhoun said. Pat said, "I've got your back." Calhoun retired from UConn after 26 seasons in September of 2012 and spent the next several years working in TV and other projects, including his various charitable causes. When St. Joseph transferred to co-ed and began making plans to start a Division III men's basketball program, Calhoun was asked for advice. One thing led to another, and he ended up taking on the task in the fall of 2017, a move that brought national attention to the small West Hartford campus before a game was played. With Calhoun on campus, St. Joseph's enrollment surged beyond expectations for both male and female students. The school reached its goal of 9,900 in 2018, 4 years ahead of its projections. Calhoun hired Miller, a long-term assistant coach. His longtime assistant at UConn, and they built a team, nearly all freshmen, that went 16-12 their first year, losing the GNAC final. In his second year, the Blue Jays went 26-3, including a 25-game winning streak, reaching the NCAA Division III men's basketball tournament. Meanwhile, his presence has a spark. St. Joseph was able to complete a $15 million renovation to its facilities on campus. The school played 4 games during the COVID-19 pandemic marred 2020 to 2021 season, winning 2. Calhoun said he did not want to step aside off that note, and before the season began, he had no plans to stop coaching. Calhoun and his team opened the new arena with victories over Maine, Augusta, and Alvernia November 6th and 7th. The Blue Jays ranked 9th in the D3 position preseason poll, won Babson on Wednesday night, and will be at the last of Calhoun's 920 career victories at Northeastern, 1972-85, UConn, 1986-2012, and St. Joseph, where he leaves with a record of 47-17, his highest winning percentage. At UConn, Calhoun turned a struggling program that had been near the bottom of the Big East into a national power, won the NIT in his second season, reaching the NCAA's Elite Eight in the fourth season, winning national titles in 1999, 2004, 2011. The players he left behind were an integral part in the Huskies' fourth championship in 2014. He was inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame in 2005. Miller, 58, who was a highly successful Division III coach at Connecticut College, and a later head coach at Brown and Penn, has often taken over for Calhoun when health problems forced him off the court. Calhoun, who met with his team on Thursday afternoon to deliver the news, said he will remain present with St. Joseph and will be available to take on tasks from University President Rona Free. St. Joseph plans a virtual news conference on Friday. WNBA dumps single elimination games in new look playoff format. Photo: a general view of the NBA logo. The WNBA logo is seen on the court before Game 1 of the third round playoff between the Las Vegas Aces and the Connecticut Sun at Feld Entertainment Center on September 20, 2020 in Palmetto, Florida. New York. The WNBA's playoff format changes has officially been approved, the league announced on Thursday. Starting in 2022, there won't be any more single elimination playoff games. There won't be any single or double byes either. Instead, the new format will consist of 3 rounds of playoffs in which the first at best of 3 series and the semifinals and WNBA finals continue to be the best of 5 matchups. The move comes after an exciting 2021 playoffs that left fans, players, and pundits complaining about the lack of opportunity for more action. Everyone simply wanted more as single elimination rounds in the first 2 of 4 rounds didn't allow for any drama to develop. The Liberty, Storm, Lynx, and even the Wings could have been benefited for at least the best of 3 mashups. The Libs, who backed off in the playoffs, lost their first round game by 1 point and had the Mercury on the ropes down to the wire. And the Storm lost to the Mercury by 5 points in their second round meeting. Both teams would still have a shot under the new format. "We have been evaluating different playoff formats over the past 12 months," WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert said in a statement. "And the new playoff format being announced today will enable fans to engage with all of the league's best teams and top stars right from the start of the postseason, with all 8 championship contenders immediately involved in an exciting first-round action. Following significant discussions with our competition committee and playoff subcommittee we formed last year, it was clear that while the prior format's single elimination games created a win-and-advance level of excitement to the start of the postseason, The new best of three series format will provide opportunities to create and showcase rivalries with playoff eligible teams participating. The format the W played under the 2021 was a The format the W played under in 2021 was originally adopted in 2016 and did away with the traditional Eastern and Western Conference-based playoffs. The eight teams with the best records regardless of conference made the postseason. The Liberty 12-20 were the number eight seed in 2021. The new format will still include the top eight teams. While the single elimination games were exciting this season and the byes gave the top teams something to play for down the stretch, the new format is a positive step for the league. Lane Kiffin would leave Ole Miss for Miami Hurricanes report. Manny Diaz is still the Miami Hurricanes head football coach, but that hasn't stopped rumors from swirling about who his potential replacement will be. Ole Miss coach Lane Kiffin would accept the UM coaching job if it were available and he was offered the position, local journalist Andy Slater reported on Thursday while citing multiple sources close to Kiffin. Kiffin has experience coaching in South Florida, leading nearby FAU to a 26-13 record in two Conference USA championships in 2017 to 2019. Number 12 Ole Miss, where Kiffin has coached for the last two seasons, is 8-2 this year and 13-7 with Kiffin at the helm. Kiffin has gone 74-41 as a college football coach with Tennessee, USC, FAU, and Ole Miss. Thursday's report isn't the first time Kiffin has been linked to Miami. During an episode of the College Football Inquirer podcast, Yahoo reporter Dan Wetzel said he spoke with infamous UM booster Nevin Shapiro, who claimed that Kiffin would be Miami's top candidate to replace Diaz. Shapiro is at the center of Miami's NCAA rules violation from 2002 to 2010, leading to UM self-imposing a football postseason ban for 2011 and 2012. Shapiro received a 20-year federal prison sentence for a $930 million Ponzi scheme in 2011. Wetzel said Shapiro had been released on house arrest from his federal sentence during the COVID-19 pandemic. "I texted my best Miami source, or certainly the most interesting Miami source, in Nevin Shapiro," Wetzel said. Nevin is claiming that the top candidate is Lane Kiffin, with former Miami coach and current Florida State defensive analyst Randy Shannon as the defensive coordinator. Diaz's job status has been in question all season, but it uncertainly has picked up a following the university's parting ways with the athletic director Blake James on Monday. James hired Diaz as UM's football coach in 2018 as a successor to Mark Richt, who coached the Hurricanes for three seasons before he abruptly retired from coaching on December 30, 2018. Diaz, who was UM's defensive coordinator under Richt, had accepted the head coaching job at Temple a month prior and was hired as Miami's next football coach one day later in a move that James' detractors criticized him for, due to making a hasty decision and not conducting a national search. The Hurricanes have gone 19-15 over the last three seasons under Diaz, including a disappointing 5-5 and 3-3 in the ACC, entering Saturday's matchup against Virginia Tech, 5-5, 3-3 ACC. Diaz added that nobody has had conversations with him about his job security, saying, "The conversations have been, we want to make sure you're focused on beating Virginia Tech, and that's it." He also isn't worried about whether people outside the university are supportive of him keeping his job. "The people inside who are who really matter," Diaz said. "And when I say inside, I don't mean just inside the locker room or in this building. There are people inside this building, the universities, or donors. There's been a lot of people unwavering in their support. There are a lot of people in the business world who understand that results don't always come from a linear graph no matter how much we want them to, but always understanding things that need to be fixed to go forward. I don't spend a lot of time seeking outside affirmation, and he does not want the speculation of his job security to bring the attention away from Saturday's game being senior night for the Hurricanes. This is not about me, it's about the players," Diaz said. "It's about a group of 15 guys, give or take, who are going to play their last game at Hard Rock Stadium, who have phenomenal careers and deserve to go out winners." Tennis trailblazer. Peng known for her grit on the court. Photo. Peng Shuai of China drops to her knees in pain after the semifinals of the 2014 U.S. Open tennis tournament against Carol Wozniacki of Denmark on September 5, 2014, in New York. Struggling to stay upright as suffocating heat and humidity drained her energy in the U.S. Open finals, Peng Shuai refused to give up. She paused between points and clutched with her left thigh and put her weight on her racket as if it were a cane. Helped off the court and diagnosed with a heat stroke, doctors told her to quit, but Peng still came back for more. Six more points until she eventually collapsed to the ground and Caroline Wozniacki, her opponent in that match, in that 2014 match, came around the net to check on her. Only then, with her body pushed to the absolute limit, maybe beyond the limit, did Peng retire from the match and marked the pinnacle of her singles career. Struggling to stay upright, as suffocating heat and humidity drained her energy in the U.S. Open semifinals, Peng Shuai refused to give up. She paused between points to clutch at her left thigh and put weight on her racket as if it were a cane. She leaned against the wall and wiped away tears. Helped off the court and diagnosed with heat stroke, doctors told her to quit, but Peng still came back for more, six more points until she eventually collapsed to the ground and Caroline Wozniacki, her opponent in that 2014 match, came around to check on her. Only then, with her body pushed to the absolute limit, maybe even beyond the limit, did Peng retire from the match that marked the pinnacle of her singles career. Ultimately, she was taken away in a wheelchair. For a player who overcame heart surgery at the age of 12, quitting does not come lightly to the trailblazing tennis standout, who has disappeared after accusing a former top Chinese official of sexually assaulting her. Her hard-earned grit and unique playing style, featuring two-handed grips on both forehands and backhands, carried her to a 23 tour-level debut titles, doubles titles, including a Wimbledon in 2013 and a French Open in 2014. Introduced to tennis at the age of 8 by her uncle, the 35-year-old Peng is an admirer of John and Crow and a lucky cow on her tennis bag to honor her birth in the year of the ox. She enjoys Chinese cuisine, reading, shopping, and swimming, and considers herself quiet, according to the WTA Tour bio. When she reached number one in ranking in doubles in February of 2014, Peng became the first Chinese player, male or female, to reach the top spot in either singles or doubles. Besides her two Grand Slam titles in doubles, both achieved with Taiwanese partner Tsai Su Wei, Peng also reached the Australian Open final in 2017 with Andrea Huklova. In singles, besides her U.S. Open semifinal appearance, Peng also won two titles at Taihin in 2016 and Nanchang in 2017 and finished runner-up in seven tournaments. Attempting to follow in the footsteps of Li Na, a fellow Chinese player, the first Grand Slam singles champion from Asia, Peng also reached the fourth round at Wimbledon three times in singles, the fourth round at the Australian Open twice, and the third round at the French Open twice. Her top ranking in singles was number 14 in August 2011. Peng played for China when her country hosted the 2008 Beijing Olympics, as well as at the 2012 London Games and the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Games. She also won three medals when China hosted the Asian Games in Guangzhou in 2010, gold in singles and the team event in bronze and doubles. While not officially retired, she played her last match in Qatar in February of 2020. Council Bluffs Volleyball Player of the Year, Williams drew from role models becomes one. Photo, St. Albert's, Lauren Williams standing on the court. There is an X in the middle of the court. St. Alba senior Lauren Williams had a lot of role models between players and coaches during her volleyball career. She started volleyball career when she was around 4 or 5 years old and hasn't stopped yet. Over a decade later, Williams found herself a crucial part of the St. T's volleyball team that finished with an 18-13 record and made it to the regional semifinals. Williams was a 3-year starter in high school. Her performance this season has led to her being named the Nonpareil's 2021 City Player of the Year. Williams pointed to her coaches and her drive to be better as the reason she stayed committed to volleyball all these years. "Just the coaching, and I know I was super competitive when I was little," she said. "I really just wanted to keep going and keep playing. As I was doing other sports like soccer, I got really competitive, and that made me just want to be better at it." Williams pointed to her middle school coach, Terry Miller, and high school coach, Angie Lance, as two of the key role models in her life thus far. While Williams has always had a passion for the game, she said it wasn't until the beginning of high school that she discovered her talent. "I think my freshman and sophomore year definitely," she said, "coach really started to push more on me. She knew I had potential. So I just knew from her and her wanting me to get better and keep pushing me in my practice. That's something I wanted to keep doing." That drive was on display in the state tournament in 2020. The Saints were trailing in the second round, and Williams said she felt a chance in her approach. "I knew we were a little behind, so I was like, this is where I need to start kicking it in a little more, keeping trying, keep playing for each other. That's when I started to build momentum, and it helped a lot," she said. "It's a different feeling. You don't want to be done. I knew I don't want this to be my last game at all. I wanted to keep going, and that's what motivated me to keep going and push through." The Saints lost that match, but the confidence Williams gained from that match proved to be valuable. Williams rolled that momentum into playing club volleyball last year for Southwest Iowa Third Degree. After her sophomore year, Williams decided she wanted to continue her volleyball career after high school and made it a goal to play collegiately. Her talent caught the attention of colleges, and she committed to play volleyball for Midland University this past summer. Williams said the culture of not only the volleyball team, but the entire campus is what drew her to the Warriors. "I definitely liked the people and the campus a lot," she said. "The atmosphere was definitely different from the other campuses I've visited, and also their volleyball program is really successful." While playing for Midland, Williams plans to major in exercise science and athletic training or sports management and marketing. She's also considering a minor in coaching. She added she doesn't have a specific career she's pursuing, but wants sports to be a part of her future. Bucks Antonio Brown accused of obtaining fake vaccine card. Photo: Tampa Bay Buccaneers wide receiver Antonio Brown is seen wearing his jersey number 81, walking on the field, his helmet in his right hand. Tampa, Florida. Bucks receiver Antonio Brown obtained a fake COVID-19 vaccination card so he could avoid NFL protocols, according to his former live-in chief. Brown's girlfriend, model Sydney Moreau, told Los Angeles Chief Stephen Ruiz in text message on July 2nd that Brown was willing to pay $500 if he could get a Johnson & Johnson vaccine card. "Can you get COVID cards, Moreau?" texted Ruiz on July 2nd, according to a screen grab he provided to the Tampa Bay Times. "I can try," Ruiz responded. J&J shot. AB said he would be able to give you $500, Moreau texted. The text exchange between Moreau and Ruiz does not refer to Brown by name, but the wide receiver is often called AB by friends, coaches, and teammates. "Brown wanted the Johnson & Johnson vaccine card," Ruiz alleged, "because it's the only one that consists of a single shot and would require less paperwork." The wide receiver and his personal chief fell out over an uncontrolled debt. Ruiz, who owns Taste That LA, says he owed $10,000. He spoke publicly for the first time about Brown after trying unsuccessfully to extract a settlement from the Super Bowl champion Bucks after talks with Brown's lawyer went nowhere. Ruiz said he was unable to back in July to find fake vaccination cards for Brown, who had told those around him that he was worried about the vaccine's potential negative effects on his body. A few weeks later, however, Ruiz said Brown showed him fake vaccination cards, which the wide receiver told Ruiz he had purchased for himself and Moreau. "They were sitting on Brown's dining room table," Ruiz said. "It was just days before the start of the Bucks training camp." Alex Guerrero, a personal trainer and co-founder of TB12 with Tom Brady, arrived at Brown's house the same night to help the 33-year-old pro bowler recover from knee surgery. According to Ruiz, Guerrero took a photograph of Brown's vaccination card while they were there. To document the list of vaccinated players as quickly as possible, the Bucks would sometimes have Guerrero or others in the organization photograph the cards they sent to the head trainer, Bobby Slater, and eventually to their infection control officer. Ruiz said he believes Guerrero was unaware the card was fake. Guerrero declined comment for the story. Ruiz's story calls into question Brown's vaccine status. Brown's lawyer, however, said in a statement Thursday afternoon to the Times that Brown is vaccinated. Antonio Brown appreciates the severity of the pandemic, which is why he got the vaccine, and supports everyone for whom is advisable to get the vaccine, Sean Burstyn texted. "Coronavirus has hit close to home as it took him out of the game. He is healthy, vaccinated, and ready to win another Super Bowl. One of the worst parts of the pandemic has been movement to cast doubt on the country's vaccination programs with baseless, vindictable tabloid gossip. The Bucks would not make Brown available for the Times for an interview. Bucks officials and Brown's agent declined to discuss the story, and Brown did not respond to messages left on his cell phone. Brown is recovering from a foot injury sustained on a Thursday night football game at Philadelphia on October 14th. According to NFL spokesperson Brian McCarthy, teams are responsible for verifying personnel and player vaccination status. Players are supposed to present the cards to club medical staff or the infection control officer. Any attempt by team personnel or players to use a fake card will be reviewed under the personal conduct policy and may subject an individual to discipline. In addition, creating and using and or selling such cards is a felony subject to fines up to 5 years in prison. Brown, who had a violent altercation after a bill dispute early last year, has already been subject to recent NFL scrutiny. The league has suspended him for the first 8 games of the 2020 season for multiple violations of the league's personal conduct policy. 6 days before the September 9th season opener, Bucks coach Bruce Arians proudly announced that his team was 100% vaccinated, including every player, coach, and staff member. Brown became one of the only one of the only a few Tampa Bay players to be infected with COVID-19 this season, missing one game because of it, the Week 3 game in Los Angeles against the Rams, which the Bucs lost. Players who are vaccinated can return to work if they are asymptomatic and pass two COVID tests in 24 hours apart. Instead, Brown endured the same 10-day waiting period imposed on unvaccinated players who test positive for the virus. In an agreement between the NFL and the NFL Players Association, unvaccinated players face a long list of stringent protocols enacted by the league, which include social distancing, wearing a mask at all times, weight room capacity is limited to 15 players. The NFL does not hesitate to punish teams and players for disregarding COVID protocols. On November 19th, the Green Bay Packers were fined $300,000 for not enforcing league rules with players. Two unvaccinated Packers, star quarterback Aaron Rodgers and wide receiver Alan Lazard, were fined $14,650 each. It is unclear whether Brown ultimately got the vaccine, but according to Ruiz, at least over the summer, Brown tried to avoid it. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 19th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa, 877-404-4747. I'm Logan Culbridge from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.